Hello there, this is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, back from vacation. Thanks so much for listening. A hearty Monday welcome to our new Takeaway stations in WPLN in Nashville, Tennessee, Vermont Public Radio, WKAR in East Lansing, Michigan, WNNZ in Westfield, Massachusetts, the good folks at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and the Mississippi State Network. Hello and thanks for being with us. This hour, our focus is the so-called rules of war and conflict established in the last century that were supposed to keep civilians out of the line of fire. Remember that? The conduct of war was envisioned by so-called state actors playing by the same rules with consequences for nations who violate the rules of war. 100 years ago, there was no rule book when the great powers used the frightening new warfighting technologies of the 20th century at the outset of World War I. That is a reenactment of one of the great naval disasters of all time, the deliberate sinking by a German submarine in 1915 of the British cruise liner, the Lusitania. Almost 1,200 people died. Nearly a century later, the apparent deliberate downing of a civilian jetliner in a combat zone in Ukraine that killed hundreds calls out for the world to once again remember the Lusitania, or to at least remember that the rules of war are apparently one of its modern victims.
The norms and laws that have been built up over centuries to defend civilians in war, sanctified in the Geneva Conventions after the Second World War, are being lost.
David Miliband, president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee, on The Takeaway last Friday. We will talk later this hour about how the abuses of World War I set the stage for the Geneva Convention and our modern rules for protecting civilians during war. But in our century, it seems to be the civilians who are targeted most of all. In Syria, hundreds of thousands of civilians dead. The mounting civilian casualties in Gaza as Israel cries foul about civilians used as human shields. President Obama conceded on Friday that the U.S. has not stuck to the letter of the Geneva Convention in matters of war prisoners.
In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, we did some things that were wrong. We did a whole lot of things that were right, but we tortured some folks. We did some things that were contrary to our values.
President Obama. We begin our coverage of all this with an update on the humanitarian crisis of the moment in Gaza. James Rawley is in Jerusalem, just back from Gaza. He's humanitarian coordinator for the Occupied Palestinian Territory for the United Nations.
We are now looking at a health and humanitarian disaster that is unfolding in front of our eyes. I mean, the situation there is very dire. You know, Gaza is a very small place to begin with, and now 40% of Gaza has been absorbed into a buffer zone, so you have this incredible population density in an area where conflict is taking place throughout the Gaza Strip. There is literally no safe place in Gaza. You know, we have over 1,700 dead Palestinians, 85% of them are civilians, and close to 400 are children. At one point, we were losing a child to the conflict every hour, and we have over 9,000 people that are injured. So places that should be safe, schools, hospitals, homes, and UN facilities, and I do want to talk about that in a moment, have all been damaged or destroyed. And innocent people have been and continue to be killed in them. And just to give you an idea of the magnitude of the what we call the human displacement, the people that are on the move, the figures now are up to almost 500,000. I think 490,000 is the latest figure we have. That's more than 25% of the entire population of Gaza. We just can't keep coping with this type of staggering human displacement.
To recap, we've got 40% displaced in an area that's already among the most dense places in the world, and United Nations facilities are no sanctuary. Does that about size it up?
Yeah, I mean, I think the number to be is more in the range of 30%, about 490,000 out of a population of 1.8 million. But, you know, that's still a staggering statistic. Yeah, and on the protection, when I was in Gaza the last couple of days, a number of people came up to me saying, hey, isn't your job to protect people? And I said, yes, and we are failing at that job. It's really absolutely painful for me to report once again that yesterday another UNRWA facility was hit by the Israeli Defense Force, and we lost 10 Palestinians, including an UNRWA worker that were just standing out inside of the facilities. And the parties, and of course not only the Israelis, but also the de facto authorities, have a responsibility under international human rights law and international humanitarian law to stay away from the civilian population. And these are, you know, 85% of the people that have been killed are civilians. I'd just like to add, John, there's one other disaster. I mentioned quickly the humanitarian disaster that's unfolding. The health disaster in Gaza, I mean, we are really worried. You know, on the one hand, we have this huge increase in demand for emergency health services. I mentioned over 9,000 people that have been injured and many severely injured. And on the other hand, we have health infrastructure that's been severely damaged. To be precise, one-third of all the hospitals in Gaza have been hit in attacks. And we have six hospitals that are absolutely closed, primary health facilities, and others have been damaged. We have five medical staff that have been killed and dozens who have been injured. And some 40% of the health workers, and this is part of this displacement and the violence, they can't get to work because of the violence or because they're so afraid that their number one priority at this point, perhaps understandably, is with their families. So we have this big increase in demand for emergency health services, and the capacity to respond is much less than it used to be. And just the last thing I'll add to this horror story is we have an almost complete breakdown in water, electricity, and the sanitation infrastructure, which was functioning at a minimal level 4 weeks ago before this conflict. The one and only Gaza power plant has been completely knocked out of commission, and the water and sanitation services are operating at a minimal expression. And we're now hearing, and when I heard this morning, I was staggered, they're now talking about diseases that were eradicated in Gaza in the 1940s, meningitis, even and a whole series of waterborne diseases that have not been seen in the Gaza Strip in decades.
Talking with James Rawley, Occupied Palestinian Territory Humanitarian Coordinator for the United Nations. Mr. Rawley, before we go, you mentioned that the Israelis are apparently unable to avoid hitting civilian structures and civilians inside Gaza. You mentioned that people in Gaza are asking you at the United Nations, aren't you supposed to protect us? Has Hamas also failed to protect the people of Gaza?
Yes. Yes, they have. And I want to be clear on that. We have denounced Hamas and other de facto forces when they fire missiles or engage in offensive actions close to UN facilities or, for that matter, any facility where there's civilians there. And we have also denounced, and UNRWA itself came out with reports denouncing Hamas because some militant groups, we don't know if it's Hamas, put rockets in three UNRWA schools that were closed. And those rockets were identified by UNRWA staff, and we immediately reported that to the world, including the Israeli authorities. So, yes, Hamas also has its share of blame in this conflict, but the rockets that are severely damaging and killing our schools, you know, recently are actually coming from the Israelis.
But isn't it the case that everybody knows what facilities are civilian and are meant to be sanctuaries?
We have coordinated not once, not 10 times, literally 17 times in many cases. And I myself wrote a letter that was signed by two undersecretary generals over 4 weeks ago to the Israeli Minister of Defense, giving the coordinates of each one of the UN facilities in Gaza. And we update those on a two or three times a week. So I can say categorically that the government of Israel has the coordinates of every UN facility in Gaza. So if a mistake is made, it can't be because we didn't know it was a UN facility. Some other factor was taken into account, and I have no idea what that factor could be.
James Rawley is the Occupied Palestinian Territory Humanitarian Coordinator for the United Nations. Thanks so much, James.
Thank you.
Stepping back now, can conflict in places like Gaza be conducted under any rational set of rules? Look at Syria. Remember the Lusitania, the jetliner in Ukraine. Are the Geneva norms, as David Miliband told us, being thrown out, crumbling in our time? Diane Amen, professor of international law at the University of Georgia School of Law, reminds us that just as humanitarian rules are violated everywhere, doesn't mean they don't apply.
The laws of war or international humanitarian law apply across the globe. There really are no special places. Every country in the world has agreed, obliged itself to obey certain laws, the primary rule being the protection of civilians, but sometimes in very graphic cases like we're seeing now, they appear to violate those laws. But the international system depends first and foremost on the countries themselves. We want individual countries and indeed non-state actors like militia groups to clean up their own dirty laundry. When they don't, there are mechanisms, courts, tribunals, and other ways that the international system attempts to get accountability in those situations. Sometimes it's effective, sometimes it's not.
What about the issue of the Lusitania, which I referred to at the top of the hour, the sinking of the Lusitania, a civilian ship that was brought down by a German U-boat, a submarine? That was really a motivation to establish rules of law during World War I. And here we are with the MH17, the Malaysian airliner shot down over Ukraine. And it appears that that's going to just pass without any consequences, at least in the short term.
Well, I think maybe in the short term is part of the caveat. Law takes a long time. Is it true that we make laws and they're broken? Yes, it is. But I think at times, if you look at things like the war crimes tribunals for Yugoslavia and Rwanda, Sierra Leone, at times we do see some measure of accountability. Unfortunately, it's in the long term.
Would you say there's a black market for humanitarian violations in the sense that people operate in a kind of netherworld and there are occasional consequences, but there's sort of a secret rule book that certain players play with, including the militias you mentioned? And do you think there are any precedents for the civil war in Syria going forward in this century in terms of the protection of civilian populations?
It appears that we can design a system where people will be protected, but we aren't very good about implementing it. One of the issues at stake here, of course, is an issue that precedes the question of war crimes or violations of war, the question of whether you can prevent war or regulate war before it happens. And the mechanism that we've put in place for that is the UN Security Council, and it has trouble doing that when one of its five permanent members has a stake in what's going on.
Diane Amon is professor of international law at the University of Georgia School of Law in Athens, Georgia. Professor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The acknowledgement of sacrifice and the lingering tragedy of war keep battlefields and battles in vivid memory for those who participated in them. In some cases, the lives of soldiers and seamen are defined by a single battle, a single incident. But so much is lost in war that the accounting can never be perfect. The ledgers can never agree with the losses. California Congressman Adam Schiff believes the U.S. has a chance now to settle one human debt by adding some names to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial.
My amendment adds the voice of the House to those of many Americans, including Navy Secretary Ray Mabus, who would like to see the names of the 74 sailors lost aboard the USS Frankie Evans added to the Vietnam Memorial. Although these men did not die in direct combat, they are instrumental in advancing military objectives in Vietnam and participated in the conflict just days before the collision.
As a 22-year-old Navy sailor, Pete Peters was aboard that ship, the Frank E. Evans, when it collided with another vessel and sank in the South China Sea in June of 1969.
I remember it very, very, very well. I was down in the engine room, and we were in the midst. We had been right in the midst of the Vietnam War. Our ship, a destroyer, U.S. destroyer, USS Frankie Evans, had been on the gun line for like 10 days before we left to go on this mission on Operation Sea Spirit. And in the course of escorting the Australian aircraft carrier Melbourne, our ship turned in front of the Melbourne, and they cut our ship in half. We were about one-tenth the size that they are. The bow of the ship, the forward section, sank in less than 3 minutes. Took 74 men with it. And the aft section stayed afloat. The aft section was the part that I was in. But when the carrier went through our ship, it opened up that bulkhead. And the ocean water came in, probably saved our life. It pushed the steam out and kept us from being cooked, us being the six guys that were down in the engine room at the time. Never been so close to death in my life, John.
You're a lucky man, Roy Peters.
Well, I think so.
Who do you remember who you lost in that incident of those 74?
I remember a lot of the guys. I had dinner with several of the guys just the night before. I'm sorry, I get emotional here, but...
Sure.
The guys in the forward fire room probably died instantly. We were operating with 600 pounds of steam pressure, 850 degrees, superheated steam, and the steam lines were severed. Us guys in the engine room got burned, got cooked from the steam, but the guys in the forward fire room, they never recovered their bodies, so they died in the collision. You know, I remember the Sage brothers, too. There were three brothers that served together from a small town back in Nebraska. This was a tragic loss for them, for their family. My God, devastated their family.
And because this wasn't in a combat zone, that's why your names or the names of the dead did not appear on the Vietnam Veteran Memorial, right?
That's part of the problem, part of the reason that they're giving us. Is it because we were outside of the combat zone? Plus, this was not by enemy action. Australians were our allies. We were working with them. It wasn't by the Vietnamese that our guys died. So that was another reason that they can use to say, gee, you don't qualify. But that really irritates me because our guys died fighting that war. And as I said, we had been on the gun line for 10 days on the gun line and had been doing heavy naval gunfire support for the troops on the ground. We were very much a part of the Vietnam War. Our government doesn't seem fit to put their name on the wall, Vietnam Veterans Wall, and or Vietnam Memorial Wall, and we're trying to fix that.
Roy Peters, it's been great speaking with you. You know, you remind me of just the enormous sacrifices that, you know, just regular people make in the course of war, whatever uniform they wear, right?
I appreciate that. We did what we were told to do.
Right.
We didn't go to Canada. We didn't run. And I think our guys need the recognition for that. Too many people don't know what's involved with being in war.
Yeah.
And maybe if they did, we wouldn't have so many wars, you know?
Roy, you're a tough sailor. Can I ask you what some people might think is a little tough question?
Ask me anything you want.
You know, I was looking around here as I was getting ready to talk to you, and, you know, there are still 300,000 North Vietnamese unaccounted for from that crazy war, whose names are, you know, nowhere to be found, whose bodies are nowhere to be found. Could you say something about them before we go?
You know, both sides lost a lot of people, and it's too bad.
Yeah.
And wars do that, though. Wars kill people. And I'm sure their families miss them as much as the families of our guys miss them. So it's tough both sides, and it's sad that countries ultimately end up doing this to each other to win a point, and so many times it's politically driven, and it shouldn't be. So,
I really admire your generosity there, Roy. That's very well stated.
We appreciate you guys giving us the opportunity to speak and tell you what we feel on this. Very important to us.
Glad to do it. Vietnam veteran Roy Pete Peters, survivor of the 1969 ship collision between the Australian aircraft carrier the Melbourne and the Frank E. Evans, USS Frank E. Evans. Thank you, Roy.
Thank you, Mr. Hockenberry. Pleasure talking with you.
And now a dream of no more war, 100 years after the beginning of the war that was supposed to end them all.
The peace that we here enjoy together as allies and partners does not simply mean no more bloodshed. It means something deeper than that. the fact that the presidents of Germany and Austria are here today, and that other nations, then enemies, are here too, bears testimony to the power of reconciliation.
William, Prince of Wales, one of the dignitaries on hand today in Liege, Belgium, to commemorate a century since the beginning of World War I. Swirling in the memories and lessons of World War I and its aftermath is writer Stefan Zweig, a lover of the peaceful Europe before World War I, whose world collapsed in every way after 1914. George Prochnik is the author of The Impossible Exile, Stefan Zweig at the End of the World. He explains that Zweig's troubled life is a metaphor for how the two world wars and the eventual destruction wrought by Adolf Hitler forever changed the identities of all the people of Europe.
Zweig had already been getting a lot of flack for not more openly denouncing Hitler's regime. And at this press conference that was called, at which many of the reporters were from Jewish publications, it was assumed that Zweig would take this opportunity to really come out strongly against Hitler and the Nazis. But instead, Zweig was incredibly evasive. And Zweig was so over-identified with the European continent that when he spoke of what was going on in Europe, the reporter said it was as though he was speaking about his own physical dismemberment. He said, in fact, he had never seen, of all the refugees, someone who seemed so battered and destroyed as Stefan Zweig. Zweig breaks down pity into two streams, two different types. He defines two different kinds of compassion. And he says, first of all, there's the kind of pity in which the one expressing the pity is merely trying to get rid of the person in front of them, begging some sort of assistance. And then, Zweig says, there's another kind of pity. And this other kind of pity involves an absolute identification with the object of compassion to the end and even beyond. There was one point near the end of his life when he received letters about a German city being bombed. And he wrote back that he couldn't feel elation at this, that every time a building fell with people in it, he collapsed with that building. He saw himself as that building. He couldn't accept even the idea of necessary opposition taking the form of killing innocent civilians. Mm. It was beyond him.
You know, the German authors that went through this epiphany, this transformation in the 20th century, along with Zweig, right, Thomas Mann and Hermann Hesse. And of course, both Hesse and Mann lived beyond the war and wrote their great story of how they came to understand what happened. For Mann, it was Dr. Faustus, and for Hesse, it's The Glass Bead Game. And, you know, very different books. Do we wonder what Zweig might have written had he lived, you know, into the 1960s, as he easily could have, or, as your title suggests, The Impossible Exile? Was that impossible?
Well, if we try to imagine Zweig's response to the camps, I find that impossible. But in fact, in his memoir, he does do a rather extraordinary job of analyzing many of the reasons that this came about. And he really has a sort of tripartite explanation for how Hitler was possible. He writes, first of all, about the enormous power of propaganda, which he witnessed firsthand in the First World War in a number of instances. There's one very moving moving passage where he describes how he was in a small French city shortly before the outbreak of war at the cinema, and there were newsreels shown before the feature film. And in one of these newsreels, Wilhelm II steps off of a train and is there before the audience. And this entire audience of people who he felt were not particularly educated or educated not at all beyond the newspapers began booing and stamping their feet and just broke out into this bloodlust that amazed him, when these were people who were very friendly with him. He was himself, of course, a representative at this point of the other side of the conflict. So he saw how poisonous the effect of propaganda was. But he also, as a person who had invested so much of his life to the principle of enlightenment and education, this higher notion of education contained in the German word Bildung, he writes very compellingly about the failure of many intellectuals in the German-Austrian intellectual world to take Hitler seriously because he was so uneducated, that the very faith in enlightenment made it impossible in their eyes
for
a beer hall agitator, as Zweig describes Hitler at one point, to become the leader of Germany. They just couldn't see it.
Their intelligence was their blind spot.
Perfectly put, yes. And then he writes of how careful Hitler was to introduce his poisonous measures, a drop at a time. He talks about this sort of inurement to this slow process of allowing the population to adjust to each measure, and then they would pass a law that was racist or what have you. They would remove a certain sector of society from any ability to work, and then they would wait. And he writes how this unfolded over a number of years, so that we might think almost of this idea of a tipping point with it, where things had gone so far before people realized how serious it was, that then when everything broke into the open with explicit brutal violence, people had already been desensitized to an extent that made it more palatable among sectors of society that it never should have been.
He really identifies the actual evil and genius of Hitler, this idea of demonizing an entire population one drop at a time.
I think he did. I think Zweig really saw that. And the book is Zweig's memoir is an amazing education in a number of very important and often overlooked social forces that led to that conflict.
100 years after the beginning of World War I, why is Zweig back? Why this revival?
I think there's really a confluence of reasons. One place to start would be, of course, with this Wes Anderson film, The Grand Budapest Hotel, which Wes Anderson notes at the end was inspired by the works of Stefan Zweig. But I think wherever people are on the political spectrum at this moment, we have a sense of personal freedom being jeopardized. We certainly find intellectual labor not necessarily valued in this culture. And many of Zweig's essays were really quite stunningly prescient about some of the issues that we face today. He talks about the what it means for news to be received 24/7 through the wireless, about this transition, so that people feel constantly besieged with the world's disasters and crushed wherever they are, sort of helplessly trying to identify, trying to create some barrier of in fact desensitization against these. And he speaks over and over about the desperate struggle between humanity's best influences, the positive and negative powers of technology to facilitate or impede this, and the threat to individuality. This is a huge theme for Zweig. So I think it's one reason that his work remains so compelling.
George Prochnik is the author of The Impossible Exile, Stefan Zweig at the End of the World. Thanks so much.
Oh, it's a real pleasure.
You can catch up on that conversation and listen back to anything on the program if you check us out at thetakeaway.org. We want to let you know how to get an early jump on all of our conversations, especially for you new listeners. Be part of our listener response network by signing up for our texts. You'll get a text a day. We ask you a question featured on the next day's program, so your voice becomes part of the on-air conversation. Just text the word START to 69866. That's START to 69866. Messaging and data rates may apply. You can reply stop to just opt out. Thanks so much for listening, especially to our new listeners today. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.